talks we've heard so far, in some ways working in a different sector of cosmology, maybe a little more directly related to late time than early time. But I think there's some ways in which it's very similar in spirit, especially to what Matt was talking about this morning, in looking for some perhaps observable consequences to one side effect. So here's the general philosophy and motivation. I want to look for possible dark matter candidates in compactification string theory. This is really to try to explore some corner of the landscape. We want to know what's the UV completion or understanding of the effective field theory that we see now. That's really, again, a similar goal between trying to understand an internal inflation and even dark matter. If you want to try and talk about constraints or predictions on the whole landscape, that's fairly difficult. I guess, as Matt was saying this morning, maybe we can see bubble collisions if we're lucky that inflation lasted just the right length of time. But maybe we can find some other predictions or consequences that we can hammer on a specific set of models. So I'm looking at what's probably the best explored or best understood corner of the landscape, which I'll describe in a little bit. Hopefully, this will be a pointer to some interesting cases that might be worth studying in more detail. So this is going to be sort of a very cursory or overview kind of exploration, just, again, searching for the interesting places to study more carefully. And, well, who knows, an ultimate goal far down the road could be eventually to connect to more phenomenological dark matter modeling. Some people have been thinking along those lines already. But right now, I'm just going to confine myself to looking for states that are actually long-lived enough to be dark matter. Along the way, since this is a holography, holographic cosmology conference, I'll point out that this is an interesting case study of how traditional holography has affected string cosmology over the last 6 or 7 years. So I'm going to start by giving a review or brief history of the relationship between holography and string cosmology. Then I'll set up where we might be getting these dark matter candidates from. Talk about reheating from inflation and the Kaluza-Klein states that might be left over as relics and why they might be long-lived. Then I'll discuss in a bit more detail what the spectrum of these models is, what the dark matter candidates might be. And then I'll go ahead and discuss interactions and decay rates and pick out certain cases where our potential dark matter candidates are actually long-lived enough to be dark matter. And then I'll just wrap up with some discussion. Okay, so in place of the normal review of flux compactification, let me start by talking about AESCs. So we know about 11 years ago, Malmesana realized that ADS5 is dual to n equals 4 Yang Mills, which is first conformal field theory. Not that long after, in the grand scheme of things, Randall and Sundaram also realized that if you have an ADS type geometry, this gives some warp factor, and that can be used to create a hierarchy between, say, the Planck and TV scale. And as I said, this was somewhat similar timing. Not long after Randall Sundaram came out, Hermann Verlinde realized that perhaps we can connect these two different roles for ADS5. Imagine taking D3 brains, building up a stack of them on a torus. You get some long ADS throat. This is precisely what the ADS CFT correspondence does. But this is, in some moral sense, it's a compactification, except you get this infinitely long ADS throat. And of course, you haven't done anything about the moduli of the compactification. So it's not realistic, but it shows that there could be some connection between these ideas of holographic duality and Randall Sundaram in a concrete string setup.
a little bit earlier, actually, people had been starting to study compactifications of string theory and M theory with more than just the metric turned on, so supergravity fluxes. The earliest completely stable case that I know of is due to the Beckers in about 1996, who studied M theory on Clavial fourfolds with fluxes, so compactifying the three dimensions. And this is dualized to type 2B strings by Dasgupta, Rajesh, and Sethi, who argued, well, in this case, you have crossed NS and RR fluxes, which stabilize the complex structure, but not the Kähler moduli. So this is probably a pretty familiar story to a lot of you. But again, there is sort of a holographic catalyst to people becoming very interested in this type of compactification. It was the discovery of Klebanov and Strassler of a dual gravitational background to confining gauge theory. So this is a throat-like geometry with a smooth tip that has a finite warp factor, not an infinite, or not a zero one. And this was, in fact, in the same class of geometries as the 2B compactifications of Dasgupta, Rajesh, and Sethi. The connection between the Klebanov-Strassler geometry and compactifications was in this famous paper of Gidding, Katrin, and Polchinski, who showed that these Klebanov-Strassler throats really glue on to bulk Calabi-Yau manifolds very commonly, as a matter of fact, because they arise at common singularities of the Calabi-Yau. They showed precisely how to incorporate the fluxes and the warp factor, and also, in fact, that the D3 and D7 brains are allowed to move freely around on these manifolds. That will all be important for us in a minute. Let's talk in a little bit more detail about these Klebanov-Strassler throat geometries. These have external and internal warping, so there's a warp factor that depends on first the internal dimensions that gives a hierarchy for the space-time, but also the internal geometry is not just Klebanov, it's a warp Klebanov. Locally, in the throat, as long as you're not too close to the tip or too close to the Klebanov, the geometry of the throat looks like a conifold, which I can write this way, where the angular directions, or it's called a T11, or it's very close to being an S3 cross S2, topologically. Okay. Furthermore, in this region where you can think of the internal geometry as being a conifold, the spacetime plus the radial direction of the conifold pair together and form ADS5. And I'll just take this set of coordinates. This is convenient. What this means is this large portion of the throat is a geometry that's dual not just to a confining field theory, but actually to a conformal field theory. There are logarithmic corrections to this geometry. So there are, again, corrections to whatever predictions you might have from the CFT, but these are subleading. Well, for example, again, far enough away from the tip, the so the flux numbers that multiply the log corrections are smaller than the overall flux number of the ADS part of the warp factor. Okay. So this is, again, it's a bit of a squint your eyes and wave your hands a little bit, but for the kind of order of magnitude calculations that I want to do today, this is certainly a sufficient approximation. People have even used this approximation very heavily in talking about inflationary potentials, where, of course, you want to be much more careful. So you can take that how you want about the inflationary potentials, but at least it shows this is a reasonable approximation of it.
Yeah, in terms of boundary approach, you also have the finite, the one, which also becomes important, right?
Yeah.
This is really, not good near the boundary or near the tip, but in the middle, it's reasonable enough. Okay. And again, just to reinforce, there is a smooth tip down at the bottom. This doesn't go all the way to z equals infinity, but it stops at some z naught, where there's some finite free sphere that S2 pinches off. But it is a smooth geometry.
So you're following Fermat's trussing,
and
practice using
Fermat's. It's actually rolling Klebanov with. But yeah, this is the common approximation to Klebanov-Strassler that people do when working with cosmology. Again, because there are enough orders of magnitude error you can get due to choices of fluxes and other model-dependent things that I'll mention later, that it's not worth doing such a careful treatment of the actual geometry.
But when you make signals like it's just the same thing with log corrections, which is only done here, but I mean, you're not actually using this.
I mean, you use it only in a very tangential way. Is it? So I'll explain that in a minute.
Okay, just to mention how this connects onto cosmology again, of course, is that people finally have some set of compactifications with a lot of the moduli stabilized classically. It was shown by KKLT that you could stabilize the Kähler moduli and the Brain moduli by quantum non-perturbative effects. There are a number of papers that talked about alpha prime corrections that can also stabilize these moduli. This stabilization, or the potential you get from the stabilization, can be used to drive inflation. And for me, that's going to yield the Kaluza-Klein relics after reheating. But just generally speaking, if we take, for example, brain inflation or inflation driven by the motion of brains, it's really, the non-perturbative potential that stabilizes the Kähler moduli that drives the motion, say D3 brain, is worked out in some detail by Bauman et al. They get some inflection point potential, familiar to many of you. And the interaction, they argued, is dual to Vebs of Carroll Fields in the appropriate field theory. But in follow-up work, a number of members of that collaboration have said, well, rather than talking about the 4D effective field theory, we can ask, how does this stabilization mechanism act on the geometry? So having, say, some non-perturbative physics should in some way deform the 10-dimensional geometry. And we know how to classify deformations of field theories dual to these throats. And we can therefore, talk about what the geometry looks like with these deformations. Dave argued actually that, in fact, it is good enough to use sort of just the behavior of the deformations that you get purely from the conformal field theory. The reason is sort of anything that the non-perturbative physics of moduli stabilization might do to this, whatever the radial behavior of these deformations, it has to act on anything that's already sourced by the smallish deviation of the background geometry from being ADS. So it's a subleading effect acting on a subleading effect in a way. So the main behavior of the deformations is really controlled by the conformal invariance. And that's the main thing that's going to come up for me, just to say, I know what the deformations look like. I don't have to try to solve, some incredibly complicated geometry problem. I can just go look up what the appropriate behavior is. But what's furthermore interesting is that we're guaranteed that the moduli stabilization mechanism has to source certain sets of deformations. And so this is going to, well, again, some of these deformations will be key for understanding how some of our dark matter candidates can decay. So we'll come back to that later. So where does this come from? Imagine we have inflation ending, say brain inflation, Well, the point is, the inflaton is going to couple the many sectors of the compactification, not just the standard model. So in a typical example, you might have brain inflation happening in some relatively short throat at some high scale, so you get high scale inflation. But the standard model, you may want to live in some TEV scale throat, where the hierarchy is generated through the Randall-Sundrum mechanism. The KK modes will be excited in both throats, and the energy's got to spread or tunnel through the extra dimensions one way or the other. But the point is, you're going through a lot of closed string degrees of freedom. You're not directly just coupling to the open strings of the standard model. What this means is you've got chances for energy to get stuck in the closed strings as relics, and you know, that's going to be our dark matter. There have been a number of people who've worked on reheating in brain inflation and other string inflation models, so there are a few references. The one that brought up this point about relics is Kaufman and Yee, and they said, well, look, these Klebanov-Strassler throats, if you decompactify them, so you don't glue them onto the Clavielle, they actually have a true isometry due to the fact that this T11, it's got an SU2 cross SU2 mod U1 isometry, which the full Klebanov-Strassler geometry still has. And it's only broken by bulk effects, stuff that's glued on to due to the gluing to the Clavielle. But Kaluza-Klein modes, their wave function is more localized towards the bottom of the throat because it's more energetically effective for them to sit down at low warp factor. So these are potentially long-lived just because they don't feel the breaking of the isometry very well. And in fact, this is similar to many other throats that you could imagine sticking onto these Clavielles just because there tend to be a lot of isometries around these singular points. You can think about it either way, as I mentioned here. There are a couple of views. Kaufman and Yee presented as saying, well, if you just look in the inflationary throat and all the brains have annihilated, these things could overclose the universe. Or another point of view, so Xingang Chen and Henry Tai argued that if you look at the couplings, these KK modes can actually thermalize, and in sort of either length throat. And in that case, just as the temperature goes down, if you have a TEV scale throat, then through the magic of WIMPs, you end up with sort of the right density to be dark matter. So maybe we should think of it as a dark matter candidate. Yeah. Yeah. Well, so the metric feels all the throats. So since it, what? Yeah, in fact, it would feel the inflationary throat even more strongly than our throat, just because the warp factor is larger. So, from the point of view of the effective field theory, you can just calculate the mass density of these things, and you'd worry that. Okay, so not going to be able to write down the complete one, perhaps. But so again, the full 10-dimensional metric is this. Warped one. And so what's going to happen with this warp factor is that it shrinks down to some small value at one point. So say A of some Y naught is, this is going to be something like 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus 4. This is where inflation is going to live. And then in most other places, this is near 1. And then down in some other region where the standard model is going to live, this may be, say, 10 to the minus 13. This would give you some TV hierarchy. So the wave function of perturbative gravitons, okay, is just this. So, in fact, again, this is just like the Randall-Sundrum mechanism. Things at larger warp factor are higher mass, even than things at lower warp factor. So if you have any relics left here, they have a higher mass because it's set by the scale of the inflationary throat. So you have these very massive objects. If they can't decay, you'd worry that, you know, you're going to have too much stuff. Yes, that would be the idea in this particular model. Well, because the metric fuels everything. Yeah. But if we're living in 10, well, yeah, the point's really that the metric fuels everything. Sure. Yeah. Because otherwise you'd have a cake name mode or something like that. All right. Okay. My point of view, you can go either way. You can ask, is the decay rate fast enough in the inflationary throat that you can get rid of these relics before nucleosynthesis and save everything? Or you can say, well, you know, they've got the right density to be dark matter, and we can ask, assume this is TeV scale. Can they really be long-lived enough to be dark matter? And that's the point of view that I'm going to be taking today, just asking, if we assume that the energy somehow gets to a TeV scale throat, then, you know, is it long-lived enough to be TeV scale dark matter? So that's just the point of view. I'm going to give you the formulas for the lifetimes and enough generality that you can see how you switch it around. Just a really quick recap of previous studies. I mentioned before, there were some estimates of how these KK modes can thermalize in a few different papers on reheating. I'd be sort of remiss in a holographic cosmology conference not to mention some work by von Harling and Heidecker talking about these KK modes in the Klebanov-Strassler throats, but replacing the Klebanov-Strassler throats by the gauge theory on some D-brains at a conifold point and treating the KK modes as blue balls. They, however, did not consider the angular charge, so their results are a little bit different for that reason. Most of the detailed work on KK or angular KK modes as relics or dark matter has been focusing on only the graviton, KK graviton. But in that case, there's been a fairly detailed thermal history worked out. The only issue I have, I guess, is that the interactions and decays among just the gravitons are not really generically the same as you have among all the supergravity modes. So again, we're going to cast a wider net, but not go in as much detail. Bernstein, Klein, and Stoica did a classification of angular KK modes and looked at some of their decay rates. They didn't have sort of all the appropriate deformations, including the ones that arise from the moduli stabilization. So in some ways, I'm doing a reanalysis of their work. But one thing that's in common is that they tried to identify among all the different supergravity modes what's the lightest angular KK state. And we're going to also try to do a question. No, okay. So what I'm going to do now is reconsider the angular KK modes and scan the decay rates, taking into account, these quantum mechanical or alpha prime sourced deformations, not just the classical ones. So motion on the T11 direction. So again, let me describe what these angular charges are to talk about the spectrum, because it's useful for us to classify states and the deformations in the metric by what kind of motion they have on these angular directions of the T11. So we're looking at representations of the SU2 cross SU2 by U1 isometry group. Of course, because SU2 cross SU2, there's two spins, J and L, one for each SU2. And then there's a difference of their z component spins due to the fact that there's this u1 modding them out. The sum of the z components is constrained. So for example, if you're considering a mode which is a scalar on the t11, the total z component has to be zero. So the representations, you're just thinking in terms of SU2, are maybe a little bit funny looking because you have this constraint between the z components that you have. So the states of interest, which I'll describe in a little more detail momentarily, there's some light states like moduli of the compactification or moduli that are stabilized at a scale beneath the KK scale. D-brain or potentially standard model degrees of freedom, and I'll give a couple of different cases of possible standard model. These are particularly interesting as decay products of the dark matter, or you know, if you were to go back and re-study the thermal history in one of these models, those could be end states of the thermalization process. So sinks if the KK modes don't freeze, the dark matter doesn't freeze out fast enough. Then we look at the KK modes, both the ones that have this SU2 cross SU2 by U1 charge and are the dark matter candidates, and also uncharged KK modes, which can serve as intermediate states in the decay amplitude. So let's look at the light states first. In the supergravity sector, of course, there are gravitons. Those are not going to be so important for us because they don't couple very strongly. Every one of these compactifications has a volume modulus and a corresponding axion. Again, these are going to be stabilized, but in order to even trust the classical geometry, that mass has to be underneath the warped KK mass. So we'll treat those as essentially massless. There are also possibly other Kähler moduli. It turns out that if you just look at the sort of spectroscopy of just the T11, and the ADS5, that simplified geometry, it looks like you could even have moduli which are charged under this rotation, again, depending on how the throat matches up to the bulk cloudy out. Talk about that as a possibility. There's also a modulus associated with the deformation of this conifold, the throat, which controls, again, sort of where the tip of the throat is. This is lifted classically by the flux, like the other complex structure moduli. It's possible this could be lighter than the warped KK scale or heavier. It doesn't really affect the geometry either way, but it does affect the wave function of that modulus. I'm mostly going to ignore that in this talk, but it may come up briefly. There are possibly gauge fields, again, that are charged under this angular accelerometry. Those could cause, again, interesting effects in sort of the thermal history of these dark matter candidates. They can be projected out by choice of compactification. So for right now, I'm just going to assume that they're not there. Another point is that these light modes, if their modes are really lighter than the warp scale, their wave functions spread through the bulk of the cloudial. So even if they have some charge under this isometry, they can have strong interactions that break that symmetry just because their wave functions go into the part of the geometry that doesn't have the isometry at all. So again, the bulk of the cloudial outside of the throat badly breaks this angular isometry. Well, the point is the warping suppresses the coupling of the KK states to these moduli. But the wave function of the moduli spreads throughout the whole compactification. So the warping doesn't suppress the coupling of those to other states in the bulk, if that makes sense. This is a very difficult problem. It turns out, okay, as long, and we don't know what the wave function of the moduli looks like once they're stabilized. But I can tell you, for example, what the wave function of the universal volume modulus is. And I can tell you that it is much more concentrated in the bulk than in the throat. Furthermore, from looking at toy models, you can argue that there's sort of a transition. If the mass scale of the stabilization is below the KK scale, then the moduli don't really feel the warp factor, and they tend to still be spread throughout the bulk. However, if the stabilization scale starts creeping up above the KK scale, then, like you said, they do want to concentrate at the region of the small warp factor to keep their mass you know, near that KK scale. We can talk about it in more detail afterwards if you want, but as long as they're light, you wouldn't expect any big difference from sort of the massless classical wave function. And in the one case where we can calculate it exactly, it's really spread out. So among these, I'm going to focus today on the volume modulus and universal axion. And since these charged Taylor moduli are an interesting sort of sink for this angular charge, I'm also going to talk about those a little bit. Okay. I'm also going to give a couple of potential setups for the standard model, competing, as you might say, just to see which ones support dark matter better. So you could imagine a standard model living on some stack of D3 brains or anti-brains sitting down at the bottom of the throat. So these brains are for one reason or another, drawn to the tip of the throat and stuck there. But again, let's assume that that scale is not any heavier than the KK scale and treat the brain states as light, because after all, the standard model should be lighter than the KK scale. And you think of the brain scalars as being the supersymmetric partners of the standard model fermions, so they're reasonable decay final state candidates. But we can also work out what the brain fermions look like, or what their action looks like. That's because the D3 brain action that Albion talked about actually generalizes to sticking in the 10-dimensional superspace fields, not just the regular bosonic field. And there are, of course, also gauge fields on the D3 brain. I'm not going to talk about those as much. Could also have a stack of D7 brains moving through the throat. So they wrap some four cycle, which stretches from the bulk down to some point Z1 in the throat and back up. Turns out the light states are, again, mostly supported in the bulk, so that the normalization of their wave function is dominated by the contribution of the bulk. And however, since the KK modes don't reach into the bulk, as I'll show you in a slide, the couplings to the KK modes are really dominated by this part in the throat here. Okay, and again, it can consider the brain scalars and fermions. So that's the sector I'm going to focus on. Okay, now the dark matter candidates. What we really want is the lightest charge state. So the lightest KK state that has this angular motion, because presumably there's not going to be so much stopping other charge states from decaying into this one, so that should still happen fairly rapidly. Now we can look at the known spectrum of the masses in the five-dimensional ADS once you reduce on the T11 directions. That was worked out a while ago. However, that's not a complete list of sources of masses that these KK modes can get. They can also get contributions to their mass from the three-form flux, or potentially even from the moduli stabilization effects that are sourced by quantum mechanics or alpha prime correction. Those are all model dependent. So without specifying an entire list of fluxes and everything else, I can't tell you what's the lightest KK state. If I want to consider other kinds of throats, it gets even harder. However, we can take the one that has the lightest mass given just by the reduction on T11 as sort of a proxy. Imagine that's the lightest state and calculate its decay rates. Now, the reason this is a really nice thing to do is that this is the breathing mode of the T11 angular directions. Okay. If you just look at the KK mass, so first of all, it's of the P wave, so something that that has j equals 1, L0, and R equals 0, that saturates the Brighton-Lehner-Friedman bound for ADS5. So it's automatically the lightest anything could possibly be. It has a simple structure because, again, it's just a breathing mode. It's a scalar on the TLN1. And it also couples pretty generally to a lot of different sectors of physics. Just as a point, if you wanted to use graviton modes as the lightest KK charge state, they have much heavier KK masses. So you'd have to hope that something like this gets, you know, big contributions to its mass from flux or other moduli stabilization effects. Can write down the wave function, leaving out a few of the normalization factors. The important parts for us are that, okay, it picks up roughly this kind of exponential dependence on the radius, and W is the warp factor down at the bottom of the throat, so some powers of the warp factor. This is also similar for the uncharged KK states, which are, you know, again, relevant as intermediate states in the Feynman diagrams describing the decays. That's right. So that's the, it's the radial dimension of the ADS5. So again, I'm going to use the star to denote that it's the state with the angular excitation and the unstar to be just the regular plain KK mode. I'll mention that this is an approximation of the wave function, but it's been found to be a reasonable one for at least the lightest state in each radial KK tower. Okay? And again, other people have worked that out before. So how do these things decay? Well, somehow, again, these states need access to some symmetry breaking and cytometry, otherwise they can't decay at all. We can look at deformations of the throat. As we know, and I've said earlier, just the fact that it's glued onto a Calabi-Yau means that the isometry has to be broken, because Calabi-Yaus have no isometries, at least compact ones. And again, there's a point that the deformations of this throat are, in some sense, controlled by the dual conformal field theory to the for the interior region of the throat geometry. What I'm going to do, in particular, because other people have looked at the classical deformations, I want to look at the non-classical deformations, the ones that must be sourced by the non-perturbative or alpha prime moduli stabilization effects, particularly because these grow into the throat. So they have a rising exponential growth. That means they couple better to the KK modes, which are also, you know, growing into the throat. So the basic process in this case is our dark matter candidate can scatter off the deformation, lose its charge to this background, and then decay into uncharged states. It's also possible that since we have these brains to hold our standard model, that their positions just break some of the isometries. If those are the particular ones at the lightest dark matter candidate is charged under, then that, you know, you can just decay directly under the brains. I also mentioned there may be moduli with non-trivial angular motion in the throat, but because their wave function spreads through the bulk, they can talk to uncharged sectors without any penalty.
Dark matter would decay in a way localized on the brain. But wouldn't that still look like other dark matter, unless the brain was us?
Right. So for for the purpose of this talk, I'm going to assume that it's the standard model.
Okay.
So I'm going to assume that it is us. Partly just because in these, in the case of having the standard model in D3 brains, then we also get the Randall Sundrum hierarchy mechanism at the same time. But, you know, you're right. It could be some other brains, in which case, yeah, you have another type of dark matter. So there are, of course, you know, other possible ways to look for dark matter in these models. This is one that has a, well, there's a symmetry reason that you might expect this to be small. That is hard. So let me just talk about this deformation briefly. Again, it's a deformation of this breathing mode of the T11. So from the point of view of the gauge theory, these are relevant deformations. And in particular, the relevant ones come with precisely the charge that goes with what we're using as a proxy for the lightest charge KK mode. These are especially not, actually particularly not allowed classically in compactification. So if they're there, they have to be sourced by, you know, some non-classical physics. But Bauman et al. Have argued, in fact, that they are. And we've even estimated how strong they are by looking at couplings of brains to this deformation. These are supersymmetric, and
they're predicted by the dual CFT. I don't want to, again, get into that into too much detail. What's important for us is just this dependence on the radius. Okay? There are, of course, other deformations. Sorry. Yeah, I'm going to focus on this sector first, because that matches up with the particular KK mode that we're looking at. There are other deformations that could be important. Of course, all the supergravity fields could be deformed. There are classically allowed ones. They have larger prefactors, so you'll notice this deformation is suppressed by 4 powers of the warp factor at the bottom of the throat. The problem is the classically allowed deformations are all irrelevant, so they decay as you go into the throat, and therefore they couple much less strongly to the KK modes. And there's a bit of a competition between this decaying behavior and the fact that you have a larger prefactor. Again, depending on the model, maybe the dark matter candidate's some different Kaluza-Klein mode, and maybe we'd scatter from different deformations. Not going to do it today, but in the paper we'll give some set of rules of how you might estimate how that change affects the decay rates I'm giving you today. Okay. Having our dark matter candidate scatter off this deformation background, which I'm calling capital delta gamma, lets us have some mixing term in the mass matrix between the charged and uncharged KK states. So we can just look at the potential that we find descends from the compactification and just find the appropriate mixing terms. Again, we can use information we know about the geometry and the flux. And so in the end, we find this sort of strength KK mixing, where K is the ADS scale of the flux. There is a coefficient that's model dependent. It can be as big as a couple of orders of magnitude. That's why it's not worth doing a really detailed study until you've found some region of interest. But this is the parametric structure. Okay. Similarly, you can find mixing terms between our dark matter candidate and, say, the volume modulus. Again, this kind of term would not be possible if you didn't stabilize the modulus, but it's precisely the modulus stabilization physics that's creating the deformation of the throat that allows this sort of term. Okay, so now let's quickly talk about some different decay rates. I guess we've got 10 to 15 minutes. So you could imagine that you have some coupling with one KK state and 2 moduli. This isn't possible before you do moduli stabilization, because otherwise, if you shifted the VEVs of the moduli, you develop tadpoles for the KK modes. You actually find that the dark matter state decays more directly to uncharged moduli than charged moduli. It's kind of strange, but that's the way it works out. You can find a couple of different decay modes with the same parametrics. So either You can have a direct coupling between, oh, sorry, that should be delta gamma star, between our dark matter particle and two moduli, or you can have this quadratic mixing and then a vertex that arises from the non-trivial kinetic term of the modulus. These both have the same parametric structure. They would both give you the decay rate that looks like this. Okay, if I choose some fiducial values corresponding to a throat with TeV scale dark matter, then I find some very long lifetime. So 10 to the 89 seconds, it's incredibly long. And I should mention that the new star is order 1 or 2, so that makes it even longer. We could also look at decays to the axions. These proceed by dimension 5 couplings. So it's through the coupling of the metric to the kinetic term of the axion. Again, there are a couple of possible different Feynman diagrams that contribute. But again, they give incredibly long lifetimes. So if this is the only decay channel that you've got, there are no brains in the throat, for example, and the standard model lives somewhere else, this could be extremely long-lived. Okay? And you might, in fact, want to look at tunneling of these KK modes throughout the compact decay before this kind of perturbative decay. You could, however, have, as I mentioned, these charged moduli or moduli that have angular motion in the throat but can then couple more broadly through their interactions in the bulk of the Clabial. These can directly couple to our dark matter candidate. There are a couple of different possibilities for what the wave function looks like because, well, as I mentioned before, we don't really know what they are in the general case. But if you look at either of them, and again, consider this dimension 5 mixed kinetic term between the universal axion and the charged axion, you can work out the decay rate. And you find something a bit shorter, but still quite long, if you assume a TeV scale term. So just decaying to closed string supergravity modes, you have very long-lived states, and it's a fine dark matter candidate. Now let's consider that we have a D3 brain living at the tip of the throat, where our standard model is going to be. Then you can find either direct couplings, again, of this dimension 5 operators to the scalar kinetic term, or through a Yukawa interaction of the fermions, where the fermions couple to the three-form flux in this fashion, and you can derive a Yukawa coupling. Because the brain is at a fixed point in S3, it might break the isometry that our dark matter candidate is charged under. If that's true, then actually get an extremely fast decay rate. This is just TeV scale decay rate, exactly as you'd expect. That's the mass of the particle and, in fact, the coupling. It's the same as the couplings of Randall-Sundrum KK modes, for example. So this would be ruled out as a dark matter candidate. However, if the D3 brain doesn't break the isometries that the dark matter candidate has. So, for example, Hassan and Henry Tai showed that if you have angular motion on sort of the S2 part of the T11, then there's a centrifugal barrier that prevents the KK modes from penetrating all the way down to the tip of the throat. Well, that just means that, you know, breaking the isometries of the S3 doesn't break the isometries of the S2. Then there is no direct coupling between our dark matter candidate and the brain field. In that case, you've got to proceed through an intermediate state. It turns out the uncharged KK modes are the appropriate intermediate states to look at. And again, whether you're decaying to the scalars or the fermions, you get the same estimate. It's an interesting estimate, a decay rate of 10 to the minus 25 hertz. The reason this is interesting is that by just taking possibly the simplest model you could have of this type of dark matter and of the standard model, you get something that is really close to what well, you could actually see. So, for example, if you followed the experimental results from Pamela or Fermi Attic, you might know that there are some excess positrons and electrons flying around at hundreds of GeV energies. If that were, you know, created by decaying dark matter, and there are many possibilities, but if it were, the appropriate decay rate would be about 10 to the minus 25 or 10 to the minus 26 inverse seconds. So admittedly, I don't know enough about, you know, what construction the standard model would have to say that, oh, this couples only to leptons and gives us the right signal. But what that tells us is that this kind of decay rate is something we could see. So this is actually, you know, telling us that this kind of standard model could be constrained already observationally.
But, I mean, just given your gross assumptions that the dark matter is a bulk mode and that the standard model is living on a brain,
yeah.
Isn't it kind of
hopeless? Comes to everything.
Yeah, isn't it universal automatically, more or less?
Probably. If, though, so I was using the brain scalars to say the superpartner, say those are too heavy, or decays into those are suppressed. So if it couples only to the fermions, then the fermion-Yukawa coupling has to do with the structure of the fluxes. And depending on how the KK mode deforms the flux and the anti-self-dual part of the fluxes, it couples to different brain fermions. So you'd have to really get a detailed model building to have any hope of making it look this much. But I don't know that it can't be done if you really try hard. I find it more interesting, though, just to say that whether it's leptophilic or not, this is the kind of rate that it enables.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. I mean, because rate depends on many high powers of quantities.
Yeah, that's right.
You really
so you
very well. So.
Yeah, it's true.
So that it's just around observational limit. It only has 10 orders of magnitude.
In assuming this, I assume that the 10-dimensional string scale is the gut scale, the 10 to 16 GeV. I assume that the ADS scale is about that order of magnitude. And I've then chosen the warp factor to give me TeV scale dark matter. And that's what gives this. Now, if you're going to say that you have TeV scale dark matter, that fixes the product WK to be about TeV. You can certainly move to much slower decay rates if you want, but if you move too far, you start, well, and you may not be happy with how natural it looks from the point of view of the compactification. But the point is that it's really unusual to have any kind of bound anywhere on parameter space in these models. So that's why I find it interesting about this. Okay. Anything else about this case? Or I'll move on quickly then. The other case of interest, of course, is the D7 brain standard models. Again, the scalars from the D7 brain have a similar dimension 5 coupling to the dark matter or KK modes. And in addition, they actually coupled to the volume modulus, which the D3 brain scalar didn't. Fermions also have a flux-induced Yukawa coupling to the KK modes, but I haven't been able to find anywhere in the literature that includes what warping does to that Yukawa. If anybody knows, I'd be very interested. You can estimate the Yukawa coupling by saying, all right, the dimension 5 coupling should be suppressed by the cutoff scale of the D7 brain theory, which is just the KK scale at the bottom of the D7 brain, and multiply the dimension 5 coupling by that cutoff to get the dimensionless Yukawa coupling. So there's just a very simple-minded estimate like that. Again, we have two cases. There's the case that the D7 rank breaks the isometries, and the KK mode can couple directly to that. This coupling is a bit smaller than the coupling to the D3 brains. That's because the D7 brain sort of ends somewhere high up in the throat, and the KK mode wave functions are stronger down below.
In any case, you find smaller decay rates, but they're not so incredibly small. Again, depending on what the mass of the KK mode is, you possibly could end up in this sort of observable region, again, for certain part of parameters. If, however, the brain doesn't couple directly, it still preserves the appropriate isometries, then, again, you have to go through intermediate states or include this deformation of the bulk. As an intermediate state, you could have, say, this universal volume modulus. That's typically suppressed. However, one thing that it does is, if you use that as an intermediate state, that can couple the D7 brains even elsewhere in the geometry. So you could still have a coupling between dark matter over here and standard model over there, which I find interesting. However, in these cases, it's all very long-lived compared to the lifetime of the universe. Again, you know, getting up close to 10 to the minus 100 inverse seconds. Yeah. So that's the takeaway message there. So let me just, again, give you the takeaway message. Here are the sort of fiducial values we took. Again, that gives you TeV scale dark matter localized at the bottom of the throat, string scale around the gut scale, and for the D7 brain, that gives you sort of an intermediate scale for the D7 brain theory, which can then get the usual hierarchy through supersymmetry breaking. Mentioned decays within supergravity and decays to D7 brains are somewhat slower than decays to D3 brain states, just because the wave functions of the moduli are more spread out and therefore don't interact as strongly with the KK modes. But D3 brain decays are relatively quick. Even in the sort of the most suppressed case, you're looking at something that's potentially observable, again, in sort of the naivest region of parameter space. Okay, and again, finally, if there's symmetry breaking D7 brains, again, maybe you're getting into the range where it's fast enough to be observed, but there are even more free parameters there, so the constraints are even weaker. I just compare very quickly to previous work. So Bernsen, Klein, and Stoica considered just these KK modes in the inflationary throat and wanted to look at, did they decay fast enough to save nucleated synthesis? And they only allowed irrelevant deformations, so the classical ones. They found one decay that has these parametrics and quite a number of the decays that we found sourced by the quantum mechanical deformations are actually faster than these. So again, you said there's this competition between the suppressed free factor versus the growing exponential. In a lot of cases, the growing exponential wins. Defoe, Kaufman, and Peloso did a really detailed study of gravitons only. They only talked about a D3 brain standard model. They found, of course, roughly similar couplings to the D3 brain, but their decays sort of within the closed string sector are very different because decays just to gravitons are disallowed due to orthogonality relations between different KK modes at the same state. So that's a sense in which they didn't sort of cover the full generic possibility of interactions. And I think maybe that could be reworked in interesting cases. Let me briefly talk about future directions. Okay, many models have long-lived KK modes, so possibly interesting as dark matter candidates, worth checking that they don't interfere with nucleosynthesis if they're stuck in the inflationary throat somehow. But in particular, these D3 brain type standard models either, you know, get rid of the dark matter very quickly so that we don't have to think about this as a dark matter candidate, or they're sort of at the point where they're could, you know, constrain some of their parameter space just due to observation. And again, it's really interesting to find that even in a rough calculation of some compactification model that perhaps we could learn that, you know, we'd be seeing something decaying if we had, if we lived on some D3 brains at the bottom of the TEE scale curve. Probably interesting at some point to think about fermionic couplings, even just from a string theory perspective. You notice I was only talking about bosonic states today. That's because couplings of supergravity fermions to brain fermions have never been worked out. And of course, you can't decay from fermions just in the boson. If we really want to be serious about looking at constraints on particular types of standard models, we need to work out a really detailed cosmic history. So that would suggest returning to reheating and brain inflation and other types of inflationary models. Asking about tunneling through the geometry in the presence of these approximate isometries. And again, really tracing up the thermal history like it's been done for gravitons. And the last thing I'd mention is an interesting future direction is not so much about the dark matter, but I think is appropriate to this conference, is that holography tells us that, it tells us something about the deformations of the throat. From the bulk point of view, these are things that are being affected by non-perturbative or higher order alpha prime corrections to the equations of motion. But those corrections have to cancel out on at least the leading part of the wave function. That's bound to tell us something about the form of those corrections to the equation of motion. So maybe holography can teach us a little bit more about compactification just beyond tree level. So I'll leave that as a closing thought and throw up a summary. And thanks for your time.
Very long list. How fast things? So are you then inconsistent with the abundance constraint?
So again, I haven't gone through and worked out the details. The studies that are done for graviton KK modes would argue that so. Let me draw this. Here's the throat, and there's the D7 brain. The KK modes are all, really concentrated down here, near the tip of the throat. And so in their thermal history, they're all thermalizing with each other down here with TEV scale masses and TEV scale couplings. So the calculations that have been done, at least for graviton KK modes, suggests that like TEV scale WIMPs, they come out with about the right abundance.
Yeah. It's the TEV masses.
Yeah. Anybody else?
Well, this is Michael Van Dragon.